Meeting will come to order. The secretary informs me that according to the bylaws of the University Senate, the notice of this meeting has been given, and we have a quorum of members in attendance. First item of business is approval of secretary's report number 413. This was secretary's report number 413 of September 19th, 2024. Report is available in the meeting materials. Are there any corrections to the secretary's report? Hearing none, the report is approved. Thank you. So I'm going to take just a couple of minutes and give you an update from the Office of the President. First thing I want to talk about is, and my update is to tell you how excited I am to welcome Dr. Robbie Belmconda to Ohio State as our next Executive Vice President and Provost. As we shared earlier this month, Dr. Belmconda is joining us from Emory University, where he currently serves as their Provost. He is a highly accomplished scientist and higher education administrator. He exemplifies our commitment to excellence and collaborative leadership, and he is the exact right person to serve as Ohio State's next chief academic officer. At Emory, Dr. Belmconda has launched major initiatives in faculty recruitment, retention efforts focused on the arts and humanistic inquiry, and artificial intelligence work across disciplines. He also leads the Student Flourishing Initiative, an ambitious undertaking to connect curriculum, extracurriculars, and campus life to support students in a truly holistic way. Before that, he served as Dean of Duke's Pratt School of Engineering and the Wallace H. Coulter Professor and Chair of the Department of Biomedical Engineering and Associate Vice President for Research at Georgia Institute of Technology and Emory University. Interestingly, he began his academic career just a couple hours north at Case Western Reserve University. As you can tell, I could go on a bit about him, but I'm going to leave it at this. I couldn't be more pleased to welcome Dr. Belmconda to the Ohio State community, and I look forward to how he's going to help shape our strategic vision and future of our university. At the same time, I want to share my deep gratitude to Dr. Carla Zadnik, who provided critical insight and guidance for the past 10 months. She's been a wonderful partner and colleague, and I know she will continue to be instrumental to Ohio State as part of our college leadership team. I'm also thrilled to welcome Mr. Chris Kaborik to Ohio State to serve as Senior Vice President for Administration and Planning. Chris served as a University of Nebraska system for 27 years. He was the system's Chief Financial Officer since 2018, and following my departure from Nebraska, he served as Interim President for over 7 months. Having worked closely with him during my time there, I can speak personally to his considerable skill, his professionalism, and collegial approach. He understands at a fundamental level how things like facilities, finances, and procurement connect directly to our teaching, research service, and patient care missions. As part of this leadership transition, we're also going to merge the Office of Technology and Digital Innovation with the Office of Administration and Planning. This moves OTDI out of its current home in the Office of Academic Affairs. But even with this change, both of these teams will continue to work closely on decisions related to IT support for our academic needs. Our search for a new Vice President and Chief Information Officer within OTDI continues, and Chris is going to help us lead that search as one of his early priorities. I want to thank Mark Consilier for his outstanding service as the Interim Head of Administration and Planning. We're fortunate that he'll continue to be a part of the Ohio State community and help guide this transition. The last personnel action, and obviously we've had a few here, I want to talk about today is the promotion of Deputy Chief Dennis Jeffrey to Chief of the Ohio State University Police Division. Dennis joined the university in 2022 following a 27-year career with the Columbus Division of Police. Since that time, he's played a key role in OSUPD's strategic planning and readiness for large-scale events. He's also developed some of the more innovative programs and services we've seen recently that align community agencies and partners to enhance safety on campus. He's been a Buckeye since his days as a student here. He graduated with a bachelor's degree in political science, and we're excited to welcome him here in this new role. I want to thank everyone involved in the search for this important position for moving so quickly following former Chief Spears McNatt's retirement in late August. I also want to thank Associate Vice President for Public Safety, Monica Mole, for stepping in as interim chief for the past few weeks. And and for all she does and continues to do to support and enhance safety at Ohio State. Policing is, of course, just one way we promote safety and security at Ohio State. The university provides a suite of information and tools, from discounted lift rides to personal safety classes, free location sharing apps, and security devices. I encourage everyone to continue to take advantage of them. Let me just talk briefly about the election next week. Looking ahead to the general election next week, I also want to encourage everyone who is eligible to cast their vote. Participating in our democracy is an important part of living out Ohio State's motto, education for citizenship. I'm grateful to this body and our student government leaders for your work on this university's asynchronous learning pilot on Election Day. It's a great way to make it easier for our students to get involved. As we wrap up this election season, I ask that the entire Buckeye community keep compassion and respect at the forefront. Students, faculty, and staff are invited to join a virtual interactive session on Monday, November 4th at 6:30 p.m. to discuss responsible civic engagement. The session is being organized by the Institute for Democratic Engagement and Accountability, IDEA, and the Salmon P. Chase Center for Civics, Culture, and Society, in collaboration with our new initiative, Listen, Learn, Discuss. We are all part of engaging in democracy in our local community responsibly, regardless of the outcome of the election, and Ohio State remains committed to building an environment that fosters productive discussions on challenging topics, even when there's a disagreement. From filling out our leadership team to our accomplishments in academics, research, and creative expression in healthcare, to our never-ending work to fulfill our mission as a public land-grant university, our Ohio State community has an incredible amount of momentum. Next Friday will be my investiture. I'm excited to share a framework for how we're going to build on that, a framework informed by all the conversations I've had with Buckeyes on our campuses and across the state over the past year. All of us know Ohio State occupies a unique position. Leveraging this along with the energy and expertise. I ran it out of battery. Leveraging this along with the energy and expertise across our organization, I believe we can lead the way for Ohioans, for our country, and for all of higher education. I'm grateful to have the Senate's partnership as we embark on that journey. But before we look too far ahead, we have to address important business before us today, and I'd like to invite Dr. Susan Gershman to present our next item.
Opportunity to go look up the materials for this already. So, if you haven't had a chance, you can go see the whereas statements and the descriptions of this, both on the agenda linked on the agenda page and also on the meeting page on the website. Okay. So we have two items. The first one is an update to don't have the number memorized 3335323. About the Council of Deans, and so if you, like me, are completely unfamiliar with what the Council of Deans are, it is an advisory body that serves the provost and the president, and it is composed of deans, but also it has included a couple of other people as well, and so the addition of the new position of Dean of Online Education necessitated revisiting the description of this. And so the first change is to add the Dean of Online Education to the rule. The second change is to remove two people who are previously members who have historically not attended the council meetings and are deans, and they're, according to reports, not offended by this change and are also in agreement that this is fine. And I should also point out that this doesn't mean they can never attend another Dean's Council meeting ever again. Anyone who's invited can attend this meeting, and the composition of the committee is at the discretion of the provost and president. Anyway, so that is that. Any questions about these proposed changes?
So this proposal comes from a standing committee of the Senate and therefore does not require a motion or a second. So the resolution is open for discussion. Dr. Caroline Clark will help manage questions posed online and in person. Is there any other discussion, any questions, any comments?
Not that I can see.
Please indicate your vote on the Carmen site.
Oh, that is my mistake. Yes, okay. Yes, that is the correct one.
Resolution passes. Thank you, everyone. I'll hand things back to Dr. Gershman for our next rules proposal.
CSP, as well as all the stakeholders that worked really hard on putting together a comprehensive criteria of dean's list that can be applied to all undergraduate programs. The problem in the past has been that the different undergraduate programs each have their own criteria for the dean's list, and some places in which those criteria vary include especially whether the students can include credits taken as satisfactory, unsatisfactory, pass, and no pass. Within those 12 credits required for enrollment. There's also just kind of linguistic differences in the way that the different programs talk about Dean's List requirements, which might make it very confusing when a student starts out in one school college program and switches to another one. They may end up getting dropped from the Dean's List because of this problem. And so CESP has drafted a really nice detailed list that combines all of these standards from the different units to create a single standard Dean's List. So CSP and we kind of worked with all of the various stakeholders who are managing each of the various different Dean's Lists to come to this new Dean's List. I don't have a slide of it here because it might break your brain with the number of words, but I'm assuming everybody went online and looked at the materials that were provided for the meeting to see the criteria.
So again, this proposal comes from a standing committee of the Senate and therefore does not require a motion or a second. The resolution is open for discussion. Seeing no questions or comments, please indicate your vote on the Carmen site. Remember, this is 335-5-23.
Yeah, this is a brand new one.
Oh, this is a new one. I apologize.
Yes, it's 335-8-3.
Something.
Yeah.
Okay.
I
Resolution passes. Thank you. The next item on the agenda is a moderated discussion on accommodations and accessibility at Ohio State. Scott Listener, Americans with Disabilities Act Coordinator, and Cheryl Lyons, Director of Student Life Disability Services, will lead the discussion with considerations from representatives of Senate constituent groups to follow. Dr. Caroline Clark, Chair of the Senate Steering Committee, is going to moderate.
There we go. So this year, one of the things we've done is ask our guests as they come to do three things. One is to tell us about the work that they do out of their office or role or whatever it is. Second, we've asked them to myth bust, to think about anything related to work, the work that they do out of their office. And then to sort of tell us what they would like to know, us to know factually about what is happening in that space. And then third, to tell us what the Senate might do to help support the work that they do or inform the work that they do. So today we're really fortunate to have Scott Listener and Cheryl Lyons, who have agreed they want to kind of tag team for this presentation, and they did send some robust pre-reading information with a lot of policies, a lot of documents, and a lot of new data, actually. So what we'll do is turn it over to you to sort of kick us off, and then I'll invite our constituent considerations to come forward.
Thank you very much for having us. We're thrilled to be a part of these conversations today. My name is Cheryl Lyons. I am the Director of Student Life Disability Services. I've been with the university since 1997, a variety of roles. In addition to this role, I also serve as a lecturer in general education. Today, as requested, we'll discuss our team's roles on campus to support access and equity, address some common myths about disability and accessibility, and provide some considerations that we can discuss on how we can continue to advance accessibility on our campus. So for myself, my role in the directorship of Student Life Disability Services is an exciting one, and we're very honored that this year our office is celebrating our 50th year anniversary, celebrating access, inclusion, and partnerships as we work across Ohio State. And together we're supporting students with disabilities on the Columbus campus since 1974. SLDS's role is to do partnership across campus with our campus colleagues and to advance inclusive systems and a culture of campus accessibility. Our team works with students to approve accommodations and to enact processes externally to our office to assist in their implementation. Accommodations can be implemented inside and outside of the classroom, on campus, in clinical sites, and even study abroad. We currently work with student program participants ranging from those in College Credit Plus to those in Program 60. And our unit is currently serving over 8,000 affiliated students with disabilities on the Columbus campus. Some of the accommodations that my team works to implement includes, but are not limited to, exam accommodations, attendance and deadline modifications, flexibility, accessible media, assistive technology, lab assistance, readers, scribes, braille, interpreting, transcribing, accessible furniture, and more. And in addition to this work, our team convenes conversations and leads education and development opportunities for faculty, staff, and student leaders to raise awareness and advocate for inclusive and universal design within our curriculum, programming, administrative policies, and practices. We also partner closely with other student life units and partners such as SASO, Military and Veteran Services, Advising, OTDI, OIE, and our colleges and departments within OAA, among others. And we also regularly consult with and meet with the disability resource professionals at our regional campuses as well. Finally, we have a formal partnership with two vocational rehabilitation specialists that assist students with disabilities on their career journey as a part of their role within the state agency Opportunities for Ohioans with Disabilities.
So I'm Scott Listener, and I'm the university's ADA coordinator. So far, I am the first and only full-time ADA coordinator for the university. I've been here about 25 years and a couple months. So either I have found my niche or I have no ambition. We're not sure. My office is located within the Office of Institutional Equity under Academic Affairs. I work closely with Cheryl's team. I work closely with our team in Human Resources that is Integrated Disability under Absence Management and Vocational Services, which is the world's worst name. And I work closely with OTBI. I work closely with Patient Experience over in the Medical Center for accommodations for patients in the Medical Center. Work closely with pretty much everybody on campus. We have a small direct report office. It's 8 people. One deputy ADA coordinator who looks at the world of digital accessibility, and another deputy ADA coordinator who looks at the world more broadly across silos. So facilities, employment, student, program participants of various sorts. So that's kind of the core of my office. On the other hand, I also have the largest office on campus. All 48,000 employees are responsible for access, so sooner or later they all have to talk to me. Right? Sooner or later we have a conversation. One of our current initiatives, and one I'll talk about a little more later, is the new Title II regulations about digital access that I know this group will be particularly interested in, because it impacts all of the curriculum material we post to Carbon, all of the space on our websites, and we've got a short runway to kind of build on our foundation and get to where the new regs are. There were a few surprises in the new regulations. One of the things that we do that's more proactive and on the training side that I want to mention in passing, and then I'll hand it back off to Cheryl, is we host a conference in April, 7th and 8th this year, Multiple Perspectives on Access, Inclusion, and Disability. Call for papers will be going out in about a week, and it's free to students, faculty, and staff. You do have to buy your own lunch, but other than that, it's free to faculty, students, and staff. And it will be kind of the core around which our annual training programs of other sorts kind of build from.
It's a wonderful experience.
So we were delighted to get to speak about some myths that we wanted to share our thoughts on. So I'll start off with a few and pass it back over to Scott. The first myth that I'd like to address is the thought out there that any student can register with SLDS and receive whatever accommodations they request without scrutiny or documentation. Now, while we hope that all students that have disabilities or think that they may have disabilities will connect with us to have that conversation, we do engage in a rigorous interactive process with each and every student to review their narrative experiences as well as any documentation that they're providing. And students will receive approvals, but also modifications and plenty of denials for their accommodation requests. Some students are not approved to register if their conditions do not rise to the level of disability, or we may ask them to go back and seek more proper or more robust documentation. However, we do work with students who are in the process of obtaining assessment, treatment, or diagnosis, so that they can be considered for provisional accommodations in the meantime. A related myth that we sometimes hear is that students can very easily go and get whatever documentation that they might need to submit to support their accommodation request, and that then they get to select from an unlimited menu of the accommodations that they wish to receive. Now, students may come to our office and request specific accommodations. They may have been utilizing accommodations at their past school. However, that does not mean that we do not go through the process of ensuring that their documentation meets our guidelines and that the request that they're putting forward to us is reasonable and appropriate for the barriers that they are submitting to us as well. Our documentation guidelines are fueled by the Association of Higher Education and Disability, or AHED, our professional international association, as well as guided by our friends in the ADA coordinator's office. And while providers may be able to write whatever they'd like in a letter about an accommodation that they think might benefit a student, we're looking to assess true need to ensure that barriers are reduced for equal and equitable access to a student's educational experience. The third myth that I'll share is that students have to speak to their instructors or professors in order to get their accommodations that are already approved enacted into their course. And while we most certainly encourage students to make those connections with their instructors to discuss the details of those implementation, the students themselves actually go into our database to request the letters to be sent to each individual course and individual instructor. So we hope that instructors will receive those letters from the student as that first step of reach out to get the ball rolling for accommodations. And our office is always here to be of support if we are finding that the communication that is required is being stifled or troubling. With that, I'll turn it over to Scott.
Well, that's the perfect handoff, because one of the myths I want to address, and I'm going to do a little bouncing between your world as faculty and an employee of the institution, and kind of your world as a faculty member and interacting with students at the institution when I do these. But that the first myth I want to do is that accommodations are unilateral, that you get the letter and you have no choice. We get a number of inquiries in a given semester that you've asked for extended time, and I teach surgery, that doesn't make sense, right? So sometimes those communications that don't make sense are not quite as obvious as that to the staff we have over in disability services. You get an accommodation letter from a student, you can reach out to the access specialist, you can reach out to my office for advice to examine whether or not that accommodation is appropriate to your course. So extended time in many, many courses is a reasonable accommodation. I've taught statistics, generally speaking, how many standard deviations you can solve in a minute is not a particularly important skill in statistics. But I've also taught counseling practices, and interaction time might be way more important in that kind of a course. So we do have a process in place managed by my office in OIE that helps review accommodation requests when you get one that is seemingly at odds with the curriculum. And we look for alternatives that balance those curriculum needs with the needs of the students. So that's the first myth I would point out. There's a similar process in the workplace. If you, as a faculty member, went to Integrated Disability or came to my office to discuss accommodations, first round of that phone call is between us. I might give advice, but ultimately, like our access specialist in disability services, we have disability program managers in HR who would reach out to potentially your chair or whoever the right person was given the nature of the request after documenting the need and having a conversation to work on your account. Faculty members have a wider range kind of built into the HR system because we have both the ADA and accommodations, but as an employee, we have family medical leave, and as faculty, we have an additional set of leave benefits in the contract. They give more flexibility than when a student presents with a flex plan, kind of their equivalent to intermittent family medical leave. But there's a similar process there to help problem solve and identify. We have an embedded person from OOD, from the Opportunities for Ohioans with Disabilities, who can help with assistive technology evaluations and other aspects sometimes when it's an employment question. The next one really kind of focuses principally on employment, since I'm there. So there's concern about the cost of accommodations. There's concern about the impact on workflow that we hear about. There is a central fund that covers the vast majority of the cost for workplace accommodations. There's a minimal kind of floor to that fund that means I don't have to buy 35,000 ergonomic mouses every so often. But beyond that, if you needed an interpreter, if you needed assistance in travel, going to a professional conference that the university was supporting, there are accommodations. So that's one I hear a lot, we work a lot with faculty on, is I have a back issue. University travel policy says I have to go by ox cart if that's the least expensive way to get there, and that's at odds with my condition. And so we have some ways of kind of accommodating that policy and accommodating the differential cost in travel. So it doesn't impact those things. Most accommodations, this is not an OSU statistic, but a national statistic, most accommodations cost less than $600. That's the benchmark that's used in a series of surveys by the Job Accommodation Network. So they're individually not very expensive. The last myth I want to talk about is the question that accommodations are unfounded, not well researched. And so there are two pieces, and sometimes harmful. I mean, that's was something that was highlighted in an article in the Chronicle about a month ago or so, right? And that I know I've heard in other contexts, if not phrased quite that way, from members of our community. So there's 15 plus years of history of those accommodations being done on a practical level. The first laws impacting those were cast years ago, and a list of the typical accommodations show up in those regulations. So, I mean, there's one piece in there that is, we've got a benchmark we kind of have to follow, and then it's about who warrants those accommodations, the work that Cheryl and her staff does on reviewing documentation and interviewing the student to say, here's where the right match is. Research on the effectiveness of accommodations and the value of accommodations from a classroom performance learning point of view or from a workplace point of view are pretty limited. It's a really difficult situation to build a controlled study and cover the variables between the variation in disability and the variation in workflow and course assignments and how evaluations are done. We try to benchmark those. There's clearly a different approach to something like the bar exam or the SAT or the MCAT that are normed, standardized tests with a bigger research pool than there are when I sit down and construct a test in a statistics course from experience and intuition. And experience and that clinical skill of judgment what our access specialists use in determining those accommodations for students. Back to you.
So following our myths, this is a chance for us to engage in some conversation with you all about, we were asked to think about some topics that we wanted to consider as a group, related to how we want to continue to be a leader at Ohio State for supporting and retaining our talented students, staff, and faculty who have disabilities. So from my point of view in SLDS, from the student-facing point of view, one of the considerations that perhaps we can discuss is you received some data about our exam accommodation numbers continuing to climb. And that's not just here on campus, but in the Big Ten and nationally. And so we have an opportunity as a campus to explore our interest in how we want to go forward to meet the needs of now over 5,000 students with testing accommodations. And so some of the considerations that we've seen in other campus models include pulling together a centralized testing center that works with both accommodated and other proctoring related needs in one shop. We also have some great college partners here on campus who are piloting some in-college opportunities where you can bring students closer to their academic home to have an experience that's more closely aligned with their peers when they get their accommodated exams. And so that will be the first one that I put on the floor.
I love that question, Cheryl. Let's put a pin in the question and see if it resonates, because I am gonna invite up our constituent consideration folks, and then we can follow up with that, because your myths were terrific and so very helpful. So thank you for that. I'm gonna invite Bobby and Sarah and Ramsey and
Ashley,
thank you, up to make some comments real quick. Oh, and Sabrina.
Sorry. Get our folks up and set up.
Awesome. Excuse me. Awesome. Well, hello everyone. Good to see everyone again. I will be quick, as I know that it is Halloween, and hopefully, you know, everybody will have a nice spooky night, candy-filled spooky night. Within the undergraduate student government, our goal is to ensure that all students, regardless of their background or need for accommodations, have a fantastic experience as a Buckeye, being able to join this community. We have some huge goals when it comes to that. Those are to enhance accessibility across campus, promote inclusivity when it comes to Buckeyes that need accessibilities, as well as, this is probably our biggest one, improve communication sharing within the university when it comes to resources. So we have done things like worked with student advocacy and throughout the history of USG, SLDS as well as the ADA office have been amazing partners with us. We've also worked with student groups like Buckeyes for Accessibility and hosted accessibility walks and things like that because quite frankly, a lot of students just do not know about how many resources, and this goes beyond just the accessibility things, but how many, the sheer amount of resources that this university has. Accessibility ties into student safety, it ties into student belonging, student success, just student retention, and so much more of what you all were talking about, and really, students, like I said, do not know about the resources within this university. They don't know, a lot of undergraduate students just simply don't know how to get accommodations. A lot of undergraduate students don't know what a violation of their accommodations are. They don't know that, they don't even know that if there is a violation, and if they know that there's a violation, they don't know that they have the ability to contest those decisions. You know, we get people reaching out to student government quite a bit saying that I thought that I had these SLDS accommodations, my professor did not allow me to, take the test for longer, something like that. And sometimes it's no fault of the professor, they may just have overlooked something, and they went ahead and took the test, and then they're reaching out to us after the fact. So, there are a lot of different things. So at the end of the day, I think the biggest thing for undergraduate students is that students do not know about the resources within this university. One big thing that we have been working on in the past year as USG is something called the Scarlet Button Initiative, where we integrate AI to help in communication sharing across this university. That would be something like a one-stop shop in the OSU app where students, faculty, staff alike can come in, click on it, and almost like talk to Brutus conversationally and just be like, hey, I want accommodations. And then Brutus would be like, oh, well, nice to see you too. Here's some information about accommodations. And that would go for, I just feel like at the end of the day, this university really needs to rethink how we get communication out to students, faculty, and staff, because, I mean, what good to have all these plethora of resources if folks don't know about it? So thank you.
We acknowledge that they're both constrained to the minimum concept of compliance set by the ADA of 1990. This means that the ADA office cannot independently advocate for access that goes beyond the minimum standard of compliance as set by the United States government. Both offices are also beholden to the university policy that supports all students should be provided with reasonable accommodations. Despite this policy, reports of violations to or denied requests of said reasonable accommodations persist among graduate student population consistently concerning our positions as students and as graduate associates, both as GTAs and GRAs. Regarding our roles as students, because faculty have no required training when it comes to accommodating graduate students, in just this past year, CGS has heard about complaints with advisors and departments who refuse to accommodate students during their dissertation and candidacy periods, as well as while performing lab work. We also consistently hear of grads that have real access concerns, like that of asking for a door button installation inside their bathrooms, that staff and faculty do not know how to address and thus go ignored. Because students who are unregistered for SLDS do not receive their emails, CGS is concerned that many graduate students are unaware of the services and support they provide. We have similar concerns regarding the ADA office, as it is a tough resource for us to find on our own. Regarding our roles as GAs, as students were supported through SLDS and as employees were supported through HR. However, there's no official office that helps us with advising abuse, program requirements and timelines, certain travel accommodations, research and teaching responsibilities, and access conflicts, mediation in obtaining these needs, and more. Graduate students with said conflicts either avoid seeking resolution or contact either the ADA coordinator's office, SLDS, and or HR for assistance, none of whom are charged with assisting graduate students in the aforementioned accommodations. Our largest concerns regarding the gray area of being a GA pertain to the ADA office only being able to support us within 5 miles of all university campuses. We question what happens when we have required conference and research travel. Additionally, CGS is concerned with consistent accessibility issues on campus concerning expensive infrastructural updates on buildings, parking lots, and landscapes, including poor sidewalk ramps and their bad conditions, broken door buttons, and lack of family and or assisted use restrooms in existing buildings. Though the ADA's office is very quick to respond to our concerns, we acknowledge their budget is not unlimited. SLDS does a wonderful job supporting us via their services, but graduate students consistently note that SLDS processes often take a long time due to their limited staffing. Additionally, SLDS is not charged with advising graduate students with issues regarding advisor abuse, program timelines, work dynamics, comments, travel needs, and more that directly impact graduate careers. Lastly, every single semester, graduate students from across the university undergo physical and mental hardship due to a lack of clear path receiving accommodations and reporting concerns regarding their accommodations as GTAs. CGS appreciates that as Buckeyes, we strive to live by our shared values. In the future, CGS recommends that the university should update the charges of the ADA Coordinator's Office and SLDS to ensure they oversee all graduate student accommodations aforementioned across the entire university. To mitigate the workload of such an effort, we ask both the ADA and SLDS receive the support of all academic units in seeking practical moves forward. CGS would love to see colleges appoint or hire graduate student accommodation chairs that would be required to assist the policies addressed, but are aware that may be difficult to obtain. We also think the university should allocate better funding to address the aforementioned access issues before continuing the expansion plan laid out in Framework 3.0 alongside the ADA Coordinator's Office. And lastly, the ADA Coordinator's Office, SLDS, IMVS, IAMVS, and CGS should work together to initiate a required annual training for all faculty, staff, and graduate students pertaining to reasonable accommodations as outlined in this speech, and how to respectfully treat students with disabilities. Thank you, guys.
Hi, everyone. My name is Ashley Swisshelm, and I'm here on behalf of
the professional students. Additionally, Tyson Montgomery is our IPC president, but couldn't be here today. I serve as chief of staff and am filling in. So we don't have as extensive reports as the Council of Graduates and the undergrads, and that was super insightful. So I just have a few things that we've heard across our different colleges, things like that. Truly, our chief complaint kind of stems from the fact that the professional colleges are a little bit more removed when it comes to, honestly, most things on this campus. We kind of get so into our own little worlds that some different things like accessibility and accommodations, and not really truly at the fault of you guys, we just don't always kind of implement fully into our colleges, or maybe the perception of those things kind of doesn't go as well into the colleges as it should. Specifically regarding that, if students are using test accommodations, if they are to go to the SLDS office or something to take those exams, a lot of times that can be more of an inconvenience than an advantage, just due to that being out of the way, even though they are getting, you know, maybe that additional time or whatever it may be for those tests. The only other main complaint is just about filing for accommodations, just the paperwork that goes along with that. But we do acknowledge that, you know, if that is something that you are wanting to implement into your academics, that you will need to kind of take those extra steps to do so. But again, wanting to make it as easy for those individuals as possible. You guys had begun to touch on this earlier, but as I was sitting there, I was also thinking about just making sure there really aren't lapses in communication from you guys to our instructors, because I have heard a couple cases of our students, my peers, getting those accommodations from you all, and then our instructors maybe not facilitating those things and making it possible for our students. So just making sure that kind of blanket statement wide that our instructors are aware of these things and also welcoming these things, because I think the attitude towards that is as important as well. I will say a lot of our colleges do a great job with accessibility in the terms of our learning, which is that our content is delivered a lot of the times virtually, and then we're doing flipped classrooms, so in class is truly learning to apply that knowledge. So I will say the professional colleges, I think, do a good job of making sure that the way that we are kind of receiving that education and the information to then use is done well. Specifically in the College of Pharmacy, I know everything has to go through our accessibility team to be posted on Carmen with captions and things of that nature, and then also giving us appropriate time to kind of digest all of that, well, as much as you can in a professional degree program. But that was pretty much all I had for the professional students. But again, thank you guys for the work that you do, and hopefully we just continue to improve the policies and things that we do have. Thank you.
Ramsey Piazza, staff senator. General estimates from the American Community Survey places the number of people in the workforce with a disability at 10.97%. With a staff close to 23,000, that would mean about 2,500 staff at Ohio State. Based on our recent numbers, we are underreporting by about 3%. Hesitancy with sharing disabilities could be from a slew of reasons. From what we have heard from colleagues, there are concerns that reporting could lead to retaliation from the unit. That sentiment could also come from the fact that in specific situations, a university unit can legally decline to provide accommodations, which can leave an employee feeling exposed. Education for all involved could help address the situation. Experiences with HR staff that manage the disability process, that by all accounts are professional and thorough, are not the issue. It's education and awareness of the process before it happens. As a large organization, we have seen cases of people freelancing interpretations of policy, the application of sick leave being one often cited in discussion. It's not a far leap to believe some might be concerned how disabilities would be handled. We often don't know about the process until it must be applied. In terms of training on disability issues, I did a quick search of Buckeye Learn. I found three workshops that sound very promising and speak well of our efforts to approach the issue in a broad and proactive manner. Disability readiness for leaders and managers, supporting workers with disabilities, undoing ableism in everyday life, fiscal year 25. The one oddity was one of those workshops appeared when I reached DIS. After I completed the word disability, it disappeared. I think this is an apt analogy for our situation. We have resources, but they're not unified in one logical place. The disability website related to students is bright and welcoming. For employees, it's cut and dry, policy and point. Perhaps we need a landing spot that covers the range of our resources and that leads to that policy, but also speaks to educating all of us about our colleagues who might be right next to us. A last point to make when discussing the issue of accessibility. Guidelines were created to make sure online content was accessible. This was intended to allow equal access for all. But in practice, what has happened is many lack the raw hours to convert their older content. So instead, that content is taken down, depriving all of us. Perhaps the university could offer some resources to help return some of that content. The university could consider proposals for groups who might need that assistance and have shown that particular content is noteworthy. After all, we all don't need to see the menu for the 1975 employee shindig. Returning to the training content available on Buckeye Learn, it's worth considering if there should be a course mandated or at least encouraged for employees to take. Yes, I hear the collective groan at that prospect, and as a native-born New Yorker, I appreciate the God-given right to complain. But in the sum of things, given the time we have, is it really a lot to ask of us to spend a short amount of time completing a training, educating us about our colleagues? Thank you.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Sarah Lang, and I am representing Faculty Council. I'm going to do my best to draw some connections to things folks already said and to connect to some of the myths that you shared. So faculty were asking this question, like, has there been an increase in the number of students needing accommodations? One of the questions that they asked is, do we see this trend continuing, and is there a plan in place to kind of scale up the SLDS office to provide appropriate support? Some of the other things that connect to things folks said around Title II and thinking about this remediation of documents, making sure that things continue to remain accessible to folks. Some faculty expressed feeling ill-prepared to properly attend additional accessibility. They argued, can there be more support centrally, software, personnel, etc., to handle remediation, and kind of unsure how to fit some of these new requirements in their current workload. And asking just for more information about the process of dealing with Title II infractions and wanting more support from the Office of Legal Services. Other things I want to highlight, questions from the faculty came a lot about how to manage and attend to accommodation requests, especially if these feel misaligned with their pedagogical approaches. It felt exciting to hear that there are ways to reach out to approach that. But faculty also raised concerns around the time it takes to attend sometimes to accommodations, and how that they balance that relative to their other responsibilities, and how is that kind of part of their workload measured or evaluated in the annual review or P&T process. Faculty also noted, sort of echoing some of what students I think shared, some struggles having timely responses from the SDL office, and expressed again concern if perhaps more staffing is necessary. One of the biggest things, conversations in my own TIU and then that was shared with faculty council was faculty struggling with these intermittent flex plans. And I'm actually gonna read this quote because I thought it was really powerful. I am not an expert in determining how much flexibility a student with disabilities requires, and yet it feels like the onus is on me as the instructor to determine the appropriate amount of flexibility needed. I do appreciate that there's now a default plan. But this assumes a one-size-fits-all strategy is appropriate, and the fact that individual students regularly request additional accommodations suggests that this approach might not be appropriate. Even the default, you know, flex plan is difficult to manage. I can say this myself, with managing so many students requiring makeup exams, reset deadlines, etc. The other big concern that faculty shared was around attention to mental health, both for faculty and also for students. Some faculty noted there appears to be an increase in students sharing or disclosing to instructors that they're experiencing mental health challenges and hence need accommodations within the class in order to be able to kind of fulfill that need. Things like resetting deadlines, et cetera. I can say sometimes I have students reach out to this. Sometimes they're registered with the office and sometimes they're not. But kind of just faculty expressing that they're not exactly sure what to do in the situation. I will say the faculty I've chatted with immediately, you know, share relevant services at the university to support mental health, but then really kind of wrestling with what is the best approach relative to accommodations in the space, especially when students are asking to make up 5 or more weeks of work. This seems to be more of an issue in online coursework. And the last thing I'll highlight is some faculty also brought up the need for more all-gender restrooms, especially in large buildings, and to echo some student things about just having more clear information about accommodations in general.
From the room as well, and certainly invite you, if you heard something that you want to respond to, feel free.
Hello, everyone. I was really moved by all of the presentations, and so I have a question. Has there been, so we as faculty have to, is required that we do report equal support regarding sexual harassment. Has there been any discussion about this being reported equal support or something like this being required for students with disabilities so that their needs are met and we get this and teachers, professors get this training as well?
So I'll answer that one. So yes, there's been lots of discussion. There is a new training coming out of the Office of Institutional Equity that is a more general all protected class training and has a segment that includes disability. I obviously would like to see that segment expanded and have some additional training to go with it. There's also some separate training available in Buckeye Learn on accessibility issues. I recognize that some of that training was identified by people who are who haven't recently learned how to spell HTML, put it that way. Right, who are real technology folks, and it's a little heavy, even the things on doing Word documents and PDF files, and we're working on upgrading those training opportunities to be a little more user-friendly for those of us who do content creation rather than real digital creation. So yes, more training is important. Some of it is in the works, and hopefully some of it will be continued.
Well, that's great news. Thank you.
And before...
I just want to put in a plug, too. We do offer some online for new instructors, a refresher for getting into a little bit of that detail about how to implement accommodations. We offer several of those at the beginning of every semester. And we put that out into the campus-wide newsletters to try to get, you know, a wide audience.
So there's always a staff balancing issue, but both Cheryl's office and my office are available to come to department meetings or to structure a training around a college retreat or other programming that you are doing. You should reach out to us, and we are happy to work on developing something that's a bit more tailored to your individual unit needs.
I want to see if there's questions in the room. I also want to ask, though, was there anything you heard in the commentary that you'd like to respond to? Because I think a lot of interesting, important issues were raised.
So we're looking at each other, who will go first? So yes, there's been an increase in the number of students affiliated, not only in volume. So one of the advanced comments that was shared with us talked about over the past 7 years seeing an increase. I think the increase over the past 7 years has been about 450% in the volume but there's also been a shift in the demographics of who those now 8,000, roughly 8,000 students are, and there's a much higher proportion of students with mental health and psychological related disabilities. And so those disabilities, by the nature of the types of accommodations that make sense, right, that usually isn't about a book on tape, that, you know, it isn't about Braille, it isn't about even extended time on testing, although sometimes it hits that. A lot of it is those flex plans that both SLDS, my office, and many faculty are struggling with. They are time intensive by their nature. Advanced question asked, could we, you know, how would those, what resources can be provided to faculty to work with those plans? Several departments have worked with Cheryl's office to build plans. If you get a student who isn't identified, who comes to you in the way you kind of described in your presentation, certainly referring them back to the office to help develop the accommodation plan is reasonable. But neither Cheryl's office or my office can, we can advise on the volume, we can talk about the necessity, but talking about what your course enrollment limits are and teaching load is and GTA assignments are is your job, so to speak, is a broader conversation than just Cheryl and I talking about, here's the volume. And so we are tracking those students. They show up in our 15-day head count. There's always some lag there, and so Cheryl's numbers are always several months ahead of what happens on the 15th day, so to speak. But there is a broader conversation about what that means to workflow and administration within departments, particularly the large survey courses, the large service courses.
And you know, one of the things that we're doing to address the growth, we've gotten some wonderful support from our Student Life colleagues, and we were able to add an additional 3 access specialist positions this fall, which took the caseloads down from over 1,000 to now running around 700, 750, which will increase our ability to respond to both faculty, staff, and students. And we've also been able to garner the access to utilize some additional 30 seats for testing within our Baker Hall partner housing space. So we have been getting some additional resource to assist with that growth. Our access specialists are assigned to work with specific departments, colleges, and programs, and that proactive engagement to try to help work together on tailoring flex plans for specific curricula or having conversation about the dynamics within your specific units is always something that we really delight in doing in advance of a new term.
Susan.
Thank you.
Thank you for all the work that you do. I have one comment, which would be, it would be great if you could circulate the information about the funding you talked about, because I'm pretty sure my department spent $10,000 putting in low pressure doors for a lab for accommodations. And I didn't know that those funds existed. I'd also be interested in knowing ways that your office can maybe work with faculty training to provide us support in interacting with students. So for example, as an example, I use universal design when I can. As part of that universal design, I allow students to drop a certain number of things in each category without needing any excuse. And I understand that students with flex plans need more, and I'm fine with that. But there are times when a student would be better served by using their drop and catching up than consistently being 7 days behind on everything for the whole semester. How can we help faculty interact in a respectful ways with students when we're proposing things that we think will increase their success, but which they might view as us trying to limit their accommodations?
You know, if I had a quick answer to that, I would be someplace else and enjoying the relaxing retirement project. I mean, we are certainly happy to work with units and individual faculty members, both Cheryl's team and my team, and kind of talking about how that might work out. I think we are reaching a point, if we have the resources, particularly given the change in demographics over the last few years, being able to do some scenario-based kind of training that would be situational and address a lot of those issues. I think at the end of the day, you know, there's a real hard balance between this is what I believe is best as an educator, and this is what, and I'm going to use me, what I believe is best or needs to happen as a boundary for accommodations. And that can be a difficult, you know, a difficult weave to navigate. And so there are times where the recommendation of what is best education or best counseling is not necessarily the accommodation answer that's potentially a bottom line. My office is here and OIU is here to help when those start to approach conflicts. You don't have to wait for it to be a complaint or for you to reach out to our office.
Not on yet, there we go. I'm Brian, chair of GCBC and Graduate Student Center. Scott, I think this is more directed towards the ADA office, and just wanted to build on a little bit of what Sabrina brought up amongst the confusion that graduate students have in our capacity as students versus us as GAs and the work we're doing in labs and in classrooms, who we can turn to, you know, for concerns that we have, because I've come into contact with situations of students who have kind of been turned away from SLDS. Graduate students who said that's not really under our purview, then we've, you know, gone to other areas and said, okay, we're having issues with this, this, and this, that kind of falls under our GA ship hat, and we're not employees, we're not staff, so how does that get dealt with? So I just wanted to see if you had any advice and what we can tell graduate associates.
So my cliche answer is, when in doubt, shout.
Okay.
My office really is tasked with addressing the interstitial spaces that are gaps in our universe. And so my first bit of advice is, if you're not sure where to go, come to me. We'll tell you where to go, or we'll create the place. GA ships and, you know, kind of the balance, I don't want to, I'm trying to think of how to best do this without, you know, launching into a long conversation. There are a number of things that are on the edge of accommodation for disability, but are not necessarily disability. So there was a comment earlier in somebody's report about the need for more gender-neutral bathrooms. The last time I checked, being gay, being transgender, being dot, 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 you wanting to use a gender-neutral bathroom wasn't tied to disability. It's not automatically an accommodation issue. We can help identify where to take those issues, even when they're not ours. So, and we do a lot of work with GTAs, and probably one of the things we, Cheryl and I, need to work on is kind of how we better path graduate students and do that balancing between the part of it that's work and the part of it that's student, right? Part of it that's classroom learning. And it's tough when you're researching in a lab, and today that hour is work, and that same data set is your dissertation tomorrow. You know, that's a hard balance to figure out. I get where we need better road signs.
Russell?
Yes, thank you. The question I have is, looking at the numbers that are provided in the handout, the graduate student, professionals, undergraduates are aggregated, so I'm wondering if you could comment a little bit about disaggregated statistics, both in terms of student employees and applications received, and how those break down.
So from my end, for the employment statistics, I pulled that together from a variety of sources and used the university's annual summary of employment categories and just piped them into that. So I don't have a ready set that's broken out differently at this point in time. And while we kind of have that background floating question, what can University Senate do for me or do for the issue? We collect that information across a variety of disparate sources. There really is no good central accounting in the way we do race and national origin and other protected class data for disability. There's self-report for employees that is grotesquely underreported. There is people who have gone to integrated disability and actually requested an accommodation, so we have some tracking there. There's, you know, even who has requested a permanent disability parking permit, so we know they fit a category, and trying to, you know, kind of pull that data together into meaningful, trackable data is different. On the student side, we've got the data pretty cleaned up in a number of ways, and, you know, we're talking about launching some real longitudinal, you know, persistence studies, but I'll let Cheryl comment.
Oh, I was just going to share that we were able to pull that in the academic year 23-24. Our registration included 1,018 graduate students and 452 professional students within our total.
And so just as a piece of process for folks, Cheryl's office is open 52 weeks a year, basically, right? They're not open on every Saturday and Sunday, but they're getting new students all of the time that get fed into our data. Those numbers are in the 15th day headcount, along with a breakdown by tenure initiating unit, by college. It was in appendix 26, I think. It's kind of far down in the bottom of the list, and we're working on having that data be a little more accurate, but it's always going to be a smaller number than kind of what we report a week later, because there's a lot of people being processed, particularly at the beginning of the academic year.
Thank you. Dean Lillard from Education and Human Ecology. So I have a question at a higher level of abstraction to just ask for information about how cost and benefits get balanced here. So what's the end game? And for example, when we talk about adding more training of faculty, obviously that comes at a cost. It was raised before of our time. But also for the students that we're trying to accommodate for whatever things that they need to perform, are we going to accommodate 100% of our students? And this is an abstract question. Is there a limit discussed? Are we thinking there's some balance here that you mentioned before, that some pedagogical requirements don't allow certain accommodations? So does that apply generally to all students? And it's a question about process more than about specifics. What do you discuss?
So I'm gonna leave the bifurcation you gave me a little bit. Things like training, things like investment in enterprise level tools to improve access are often talked about in cost benefit conversations. If we have the new protected class training that, you know, if you ask Scott's opinion, ought to be required of everybody, is not going to be required in the same way reporting is being required. And that was a balancing decision amongst leadership, right, amongst people at the table in those conversations. So in those respects, there's that cost-benefit analysis. In accommodations and limits to accommodations are a civil right. So we don't do a cost-benefit analysis at one level. There are limits to accommodations. You know, under the rules, under the civil rights law of the ADA in Section 504 in Ohio Code, you know, accommodations have to be reasonable. Reasonable has to do with context. And so, you know, I know nobody, you know, everybody gets tired of extended time as the model, but if you are teaching a course that relies and the goal is fundamentally about fluency with that knowledge, and that's the central goal, then that's going to be the balance point for where reasonable and undue burden is, the fundamental alteration. Undue burden has two pieces to it. One piece of undue burden is about cost. The Department of Justice and the Department of Education tell us that, and the statute tells us that balancing that cost is against a university resource budget, not the budget in SLDS, not the budget in the history department, not the budget in the Ohio Union, but the university's total resources. So I don't think anybody has ever successfully claimed undue financial burden as an institution. That balance isn't there, right? Undue administrative costs, there are times when the practicality of what an accommodation means isn't about applying resources, it just really can't happen. The student who needs, who can legitimately argue for an unlimited amount of time or an alternative to a written paper or any number of things that kind of go beyond the ability for us to provide it. We can't proctor an unlimited exam. I know that's a kind of silly concept, but at some point, that's not about resource hours. It's a different administrative burden. And so there are some balances there. They're very context-driven. So, you know, on one case, saying yes, we take into account the factors is easy, but the details get very granular and case specific. Thank you.
Susan. First of all, I want to say I am a SLDS super fan. Really appreciate what you do. I mean, on the regional campuses, we, you know, make a really good environment for, you know, students who benefit from small class size and can get that individualized attention. And SLDS is a big component of that for a lot of our students. But I did have one kind of question or concern about like the rollout of new accommodations. Like, I appreciate that y'all are constantly trying to find new ways to help students to be able to succeed. But sometimes we get things and we just don't know what they are and we don't have a good way of figuring out what they are. Like, for example, this year's example is exam chunking, and we don't know what exam chunking is. We have no examples of what exam chunking is or what a reasonable chunk would be. Is it today and next week and the week after? Is it today and 2 hours and then 2 hours later? Is it, you know what I mean? Like, there's infinite possibilities and no guidelines. And so I guess I'm a bit concerned when the first time we see a new accommodation is just the name of it with no information. And I guess I would love to be able to get the information before and have access to it before. And then when the student comes with the accommodation, then we really can have a productive conversation about what the best version of that is for them. And so I'm wondering what the, if there's a plan or a place to get that information or something.
That's a great question. And you know, exam chunking, breaking an exam into smaller task chunks for a student maybe has a disability related to their stamina or their physical ability to maintain that setting, you know, is a very unique and tailored accommodation. I think your request is very reasonable and understandable to connect with the disability staff that may have made that determination and have them help you with some additional context on making those choices about what would be reasonable for this student, what are we trying to accomplish based on their abilities and their barriers. And then to also work on our communication together on, there are definitely departments and schools and reps within departments that we have that kind of relationship where if we're gonna send something unique, and we're not sure the feasibility or the logistics, that we'll reach out and say, let's chat through this first before it would land to you in a course accessibility letter. So I'd love to have a further conversation offline about how we can continue to improve that communication pattern.
So new accommodations occur because a unique need has occurred out of an individual interactive process with this student. it's not very often that we, sometimes we see it because of a change in demographics, like FlexPlan, and it gets a name and it becomes a little higher volume. But a lot of those are emergent based on kind of creative problem solving, if you will, based on what the barrier is and what seems to address those needs. So it's sometimes hard to say, here are new accommodations. That process of when they use unique things, making sure that it's well explained and contacted.
It sounded like we had a good suggestion to you for a web situation, but I'm going to give one last question to Nigel, who is one of our undergraduate senates, and then I'm going to turn it back over to President Carter.
We've heard from a lot of our students that unfortunately it's very hard to kind of understand some of the resources that are offered by SLDS, and given a lot of the bureaucracy that occurs within the university, as Bobby kind of explained, USG, we try to alleviate it the best way that we know how, and the constant communication creating and developing the Scarlet Button. However, I guess our question for you is, what is the overall plan in expanding communication, ensuring that we're able to offer SLDS visibility to students and knowing what services are available to them, and knowing when and how they can use them in timeline and application process and things like that?
I'm intrigued by the button idea. I think I've seen that model at other campuses. It's very, very cool. I'm open to suggestions on other ways that can be effective to get the word out, right? We use a lot of traditional methods. We are a part of orientation. We do a lot of tabling fairs. We do, as well for students as for faculty, have multiple webinars at the beginning of each term to kind of refresh and guide students. Once folks are affiliated, they're put on a newsletter list for us, but we also try to utilize university-wide email newsletter opportunities when it's a big message or a big change. But we're also exploring whether or not maybe creating a Karman shell of some type for our office would be appropriate, but right now we're running into issues where we have to go do that where the students can't see one another due to privacy, right? So we're trying to trouble that. But please, we would love additional ideas on what we can do. We rely heavily on our partners. We get a large number of referrals, not only from our faculty and instructor friends, but from advocacy, from the Townsend Center, from our friends in international affairs. And so part of, I think, that is students don't know to look for it until they're in some kind of distress or trouble. And we do rely a lot on our partners to be aware of us as well and send folks over with that warm handoff. Please share your additional ideas.
I want to thank you both. We do have some additional questions in the chat about digital accessibility. I want to just keep an eye on the time. I want to make sure that President Carter has a chance to make any closing remarks because we know he always listens. I don't know if that's a talking issue, Scott, or something we can sort of FAQ for faculty.
So I'm certainly happy to respond offline if we're at time. I know when I speak, I assume the world stands still. I can take as long as I want, and that's not a good thing for everybody else in the room. So I'm happy to, I'll hang out a little bit when we're done, but I'm also happy to work out however we can do it all.
Let's do that. Okay, thank you all. We want to thank you very much.
So I want to thank everyone for participating in this conversation. You're right, there's a lot to learn in this space, and the questions and the concerns and the comments have taught me right away that this is a changing demographic of our university. And as we're thinking about what the next year, 10-year strategy is going to be for this university, this is a conversation that will include this. And I'm already beginning to have conversation with key stakeholders here at the university about what the future of this university looks like. As I looked at the disability numbers for the incoming freshman class, just from previous couple of years, it's up almost 40%. So this is a change in what we are seeing and who we serve. And it's not just students across the country, it's students right here in the state of Ohio. So we're gonna have to think about what right looks like. I appreciate the conversation about when, how far up do we go. I mean, that we don't have unlimited resources. We do follow the law. We'll continue to do that. I also appreciate the comment about what's wrong with going a little bit above the minimum standard. I hear that. And I always want to do more. But we also know that at some point, even as I can appreciate as a faculty member, I didn't know what exam chunking was until today, but I know what it is now. And I can imagine if you're trying to proffer an exam and you have to spend a week to get out one exam because you're doing it in multiple chunks across an entire week, it's almost impossible to get it done. So there's a balance here so that we can serve our students, make them successful, and make them ready for when we finish them here and they get their degrees and ready to go, whether it be to go into the workforce or go on to graduate programs, whatever it's going to be. So more work to be done here. We could probably talk about this topic for multiple hours, and I can feel the passion on this topic. So I just want to say thank you for everybody engaging here. And again, there'll be more to be discussed on this in the future. So with that, I want to ask if there's any old business to be discussed. Hearing none, any new business? Do we have any announcements? This concludes the business of the University Senate. The next Senate meeting will take place in this room in a hybrid format on Thursday, November 14th, 2024. The meeting is adjourned.